This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by returning guest Phyllis Menes from the Washington, D.C. Institute for Policy Studies to talk about the ongoing war with Iran. We discuss the crash of the rule of law, both internationally and nationally, which brought us to the edge of what many fear would be a terrible escalation. We're also joined by ex-FBI agent Mike German, whose recent book, Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, focuses on how the Bureau transformed after the attacks on September 11th to an even more repressive political police force.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
An assassination is a political murder. Last week, President Donald Trump, in violation of both American and international law, assassinated General Soleimani, the second most important leader in Iran, when the general was leaving the airport in Baghdad, Iraq. Trump ordered the illegal assassination without advising Congress, which is illegal and in violation of the War Powers Act. Trump, however, did first advise Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, countries which have long favored provoking a war with Iran. We speak today with Phyllis Menes of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. She is the author of Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis. We will speak to her about the consequences of Trump's murder of a foreign leader of a country whose government the United States has intervened in repeatedly ever since they overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh, the democratically elected president of Iran, in 1953. The CIA ousted him and installed the brutal dictatorship of Shah Pahlavi, which lasted 26 years. Currently, the United States has imposed harsh economic sanctions on the Iranian people, hoping they will turn against their government. Trump calls Soleimani a terrorist with the blood of hundreds of Americans on his hands, and that he was planning an imminent attack on the United States. On January 6th, the Iraqi prime minister disclosed that actually Soleimani was on a peace mission and that he, the prime minister, was bringing Soleimani and Saudi Arabia together to discuss ratcheting down tensions between the two countries. Soleimani traveled to Iraq on a commercial jet. He went through passport control, got into his car, and drove to the peace meeting. On the way, he was assassinated by an American drone. If Iran responds to the murder, as it has done, Trump has threatened, in violation of international law, to destroy 52 sites in Iran, including ancient cultural heritage sites. He has sent 3,000 additional troops to Iraq and threatened to impose sanctions on Iraq if they expel American troops. We welcome back Phyllis Menes to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Susan Rice, President Obama's national security advisor, wrote in an op-ed in the New York Times that, quote, General Soleimani was a ruthless murderer and a terrorist with much American blood on his hands. This has been the assumption of the mainstream media and most of the Democratic Party. How would you characterize General Soleimani?
Well, I think he was a very complicated figure. The first thing is he was a political leader as well as a military leader and was by far the most popular leader in Iran, according to a recent study actually conducted by the University of Maryland across Iran just a couple of months ago. And I think anyone who saw the video of those extraordinary multi-million person crowds in every city in Iran weeping copiously, just desperate for the loss of this man, nobody could deny that he was not just a military leader. Having said that, he was a military leader. He was a general, and like generals in wars, of course he has blood on his hands, like General Petraeus, like General Mattis, they all do, because what do militaries do? They kill people and break things. That's their job, and the generals lead them to do it. So that was true. Now, the notion of him being a terrorist is a whole different thing. The vast majority of casualties of the attacks, particularly in Iraq, which is what's usually talked about in U.S. circles, it's he was a terrorist because he killed Americans. Well, the Americans he killed were American soldiers in a war. And that's not the definition of terrorism. What is true is that in Syria, he he played the same role in leading the Syrian government and Russian and Iranian forces against Aleppo as the American forces did against Raqqa, for instance, or against Fallujah in Iraq a dozen years earlier, where the goal was to get rid of ISIS, and they did that, and that's part of the reason that he is so beloved in Iran, because he's seen as having protected the people of Iran from the terrors of ISIS. But in doing so, he led forces that destroyed virtually the entire city of Aleppo, just like the U.S. forces completely destroyed the city of Raqqa in the name of protecting the people of Raqqa from ISIS. So in both cases, there were lots of civilian casualties. I'm not sure that also qualifies as terrorism, but the notion that this was somehow a stateless terrorist sneaking around the world is simply nonsense. And I think the last point is that it is very important that we keep in mind how much of an escalation it represents in terms of international law and international perception, that the long-standing U.S. decision, let's say, of the recent 20 years to use assassination as a routine tool in the so-called global war on terror was always justified by saying that the people on the kill list, Obama's kill list, Trump's kill list, Bush's kill list, that the people on that list were somehow outside the pale. They were stateless terrorists that were moving around the world, killing innocent people. That's all they were, and therefore it's good that we kill them. This was not that. This was the assassination of the second most powerful political leader of a sovereign country with which the United States was not at war. So this is a huge escalation from that already outrageous process of creating so-called kill lists and killing terrorists on the word of somebody on the ground who says, oh yeah, that guy shot it at a U.S. soldier. This is a major escalation, and it has to be identified as that.
His assassination was justified by Trump and his defenders because they alleged that Soleimani presented an imminent threat. International law allows for a preventive strike in this circumstance. Was this the case?
As far as we can tell, it absolutely was not. This was one more lie. No one has seen any evidence of any kind of attack that was about to happen, that was imminent, or even that wasn't imminent. In fact, all the information that has come out indicates that Soleimani was actually arriving in Baghdad not to carry out some terrorist act, but for diplomacy, that bad word in the Trump White House. He was there to meet with the Prime Minister of Iraq, and the source for this is the Prime Minister of Iraq, who told his own parliament that the reason that General Soleimani had arrived at the airport was precisely to meet with the Prime Minister of Iraq to report to him Iran's response to some kind of proposal, we don't know any details, some kind of proposal from Saudi Arabia in which the Iraqi Prime Minister was acting as the go-between. If that report is true, and there's certainly no reason to think it isn't when the Prime Minister himself reported it to his parliament, if that report is true, what this assassination did was not only carry out this horrific assassination, put the world again at the abyss of war, but it also may have undermined the best chance we've seen in a decade or more of resolving the long-standing tensions that often lead to military clashes between Iran and Saudi Arabia, with Iraq playing the role of the go-between. If that were, in fact, why Soleimani was coming to Baghdad, this is an even greater tragedy than the killing itself.
You know, the United States monitors these conversations, and my surmise is that the United States knew that in advance.
That's certainly a possibility, and it was a situation where the Trump White House just did not want to allow that kind of a softening of the longstanding tension between Saudi Arabia and Iran. We should be remembering here that Jared Kushner, in particular, the son-in-law of Trump, is part of a little team of the crown princes, if you will, along with the crown prince of Saudi Arabia and the crown prince of the UAE, who have jointly been working for the last 2 years in creating an anti-Iran coalition. centered by Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the UAE, to operate across the Middle East. And they may well not have wanted this kind of a diplomatic resolution to that long-standing conflict. We don't have any evidence of that, but it certainly would be consistent with what we know about so far.
We're speaking with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis, the War Powers Act was passed in an attempt to rein in a president bent on unilaterally initiating a war. What has Trump done to ignore this?
Well, unfortunately, he hasn't had to do very much. He actually did submit, well, he did two things, the first of which would be hilarious if it wasn't so serious, which was that he announced that his tweets now should be considered notification to Congress. But that aside, his position has been that he doesn't have to consult with Congress on anything like this. And the problem is, like presidents before him, Congress has largely abandoned their obligation to hold him accountable. This time, there's enough outrage at the, and fear, I would say, fear is a great motivator, fear of what could have happened and may still happen, frankly, as a result of this reckless assassination carried out on Friday against General Soleimani in Congress. There are bills now pending in both the House and the Senate that would impose some limitations based on the War Powers Act. There's some question about exactly what the language would be. Would it actually repeal the 2002 authorization for the use of military force, which, of course, there's no way you can actually factually or legally argue that it still applies to this situation. The language of that authorization was very, very specific, even though it was immediately misused right from the beginning by George Bush. But it was written deliberately to say this is authorizing the use of military force against Iraq because of the threat that Iraq allegedly poses. Well, the attack, while it occurred in Iraq, was not against Iraq. This was an attack, an act of war, against Iran, which is not even mentioned. The word doesn't even appear in the text of the authorization for the use of military force. So the notion that they're relying on that is preposterous to begin with. But even there, it's not clear what Congress is thinking about doing. Will they actually repeal it? If they do, will somebody insist on passing another one to make it more legal somehow? I mean, we have to be very clear that the fact that this is a violation of the separation of powers, it's a violation of the Constitution, which says explicitly that only Congress can declare war, that's certainly true. But it's also true that Congress has to take that initiative and fight for it. This doesn't just, it's not self-actualizing or self-enforcing.
The United Nations Charter, which applies to the United States is a signatory to the Charter. It's the law of the land under Article 6 of our Constitution. The United Nations Charter outlaws preemptive war. Preemptive war is considered a crime of aggression. What has Trump done to violate this?
Well, it depends when we start the clock. If we want to look at the real legacy of this current crisis between the U.S. and Iran, and there have been others, this crisis began when the U.S. pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. Now, that wasn't technically a violation of international law. The agreement, like all international agreements, had language written into it about what it would take to pull out from it. But it was perceived appropriately around the world as a violation of the UN Security Council resolution that had endorsed the nuclear deal and had said this diplomatic solution is the only way of solving the rising tension in the Middle East. So that was the beginning of this kind of violation. That wasn't a technical violation, but it was clearly a violation of both what the Charter calls for in general, in broad strokes, and the specific Security Council resolution, which is always assumed to have the force of law. Now, since that time, the U.S. actions, a number of U.S. actions, have been in violation. And the most recent, of course, was the assassination. It was a violation of both U.S. law that prohibits assassination as a political tool after the Church hearings from 1976, and it's a violation of international law that prohibits this is a question in the Geneva Conventions of disproportionality, of hitting targets that are not at war. You know, this is sort of the equivalent if, I'm not sure how I can explain this, but if, for example, the attack on the Khobar base in Saudi Arabia years ago, where a number of U.S. soldiers were hit, and it was immediately branded a terrorist attack, although any definition of terrorism that you actually look at says terrorism means attacking civilians, and these were not civilians, these were soldiers that were occupying another country. But the claim was then made, once that argument was made, the claim was, well, but they weren't fighting at the time. They were sleeping. Oh, okay. So now we're saying that it's terrorism if the soldiers opposing you are not standing there with their rifle or their AR-15 at the ready. Then it's like they were civilians. I mean, it's the same kind of convoluted arguments that don't mean anything. This was a political leader of a country coming into a third country in order to carry out diplomacy. And what does the U.S. do rather than welcoming diplomacy? It attacks his convoy and kills him. So that's a deliberate violation of international law and the Charter. Then you have the U.S. response when a U.S. contractor who is in Iraq, for reasons unknown to the American people and probably to the Iraqi people, there are over 5,000 U.S. military contractors, and one of them is on a military base, an Iraqi military base. That base is attacked by unknown forces. The U.S. then says, well, we know it was this militia. Well, we haven't seen any proof. The militia denied it. Nobody actually knows who carried out that attack. But in response, the U.S. then attacks 5 bases of that militia several hundred miles away in another part of Iraq and kills somewhere between 26 and 30 people. That's another violation because those forces were not at war with the United States. So this notion of the U.S. being able to use force wherever, whenever, and for whatever reason it wants to, all stand as violations of international law. And I think this is a very serious reality. We're now looking at the question of what will the U.S. do next? The Iranians made very clear that their response to the assassination of their leader was proportionate and was retaliatory. They were very clear, this is not an escalation. We are not trying to move to war. So the ball right now, unfortunately, is very much in Donald Trump's court, where his administration will have to decide, do we accept the claim that we ourselves have made over and over again, starting with 9/11, that anything we did in Afghanistan somehow was okay because it was all kind of retaliatory? Or is he going to say, they hit our people on a base, they didn't kill anybody, but they hit our base, and therefore we have to go to war? The question is Congress prepared to stand up and say no? What will it take at the level of popular protests in the street, at the level of massive flooding of congressional offices with letters and emails and calls and bodies to say, you have to stop this madness? What will it take? That's the challenge that we face right now. Congress is what stands between us and Armageddon.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the actions that we took with respect to the war in Vietnam. Their first demonstration in 1965 had only 20,000 people, but it was a lot then because we're still in the middle of the Cold War. The next demonstration had 500,000 people in 67. The next demonstration in 69 had over 500,000 people. And Nixon claimed that he didn't care. He was watching a football game. You can demonstrate all you want, but it's not going to affect my policy. But we've subsequently learned that Nixon and Kissinger saw those demonstrations as a real threat to their power, that they had planned to use nuclear weapons against the Vietnamese, and when over 500,000 people came out into the streets, they withdrew those plans for nuclear weapons. So I think that the more people out on the streets, the better. Even if we don't see an immediate response, we've got to start building it.
Absolutely, and there are protests called, there's a call, a mass mobilization called Move On, and Veterans for Peace and a host of other organizations are doing tonight. There's a set of protests across the country in at least 90 cities, I think, so far. There's another protest set for the 25th of January. So protests are rising, and they are crucial. It's also important that people take very seriously the need to engage with members of Congress, because right now there's this weird thing going on with Congress. They don't know how to mix the crisis of possible war with Iran with the internal domestic political crisis of impeachment. And that has to be dealt with. We have to make clear to Congress that whatever happens with this impeachment process, they have to make a priority over stopping Trump from going ahead with going to war. There's a very great danger that, like Clinton in 1998, when he attacked Iraq in what became known as Operation Desert Fox, for 5 days of brutal bombing across the country as a distraction from his impeachment campaign that was underway at that time. So this is an old story in the United States. It's a bipartisan story. This isn't just Republicans. This is everybody in power that will use military force despite the consequences when it's something that could ease their perceived threat to their political support or their political life even. So I think we're in a very serious moment when we need to be fighting in the streets with nonviolence to make clear the need for popular pressure, and we need to be going to offices of members of Congress to push and push inside, outside. There needs to be a strategy at every section.
George Orwell wrote that, quote, "War is not meant to be won. It is meant to be continuous." American wars in the Middle East have been continuous for almost two decades. Who profits from these wars?
Well, you know, we hear sometimes from people who say, well, no one wants war. Not true. Absolutely not true, because as you say, there are people who profit from these wars. My colleague Sarah Anderson just did a terrific short piece that was published in the inequality.org website, where she looked at the CEO pay of the five top military contracting companies in this country and how their stocks went up when these tensions rose. They rise again in the oil industries. One of the things she found was that the company General Atomics, which makes the Reaper drone that was used to carry out the assassination of General Soleimani, is a privately held company. So it turns out they don't have to submit their CEO pay records. But the CEO of General Atomics, it turns out, is worth more than $4 billion, reportedly. And that includes significant holdings in the oil industry. So there's a lot of crossover here. The stock of the company, I'm forgetting which one, it's one of the big ones that makes Hellfire missiles, the missile that was used to assassinate General Soleimani, their stock price went up 3% overnight. So this is a very direct question of who profits from these wars. It doesn't mean that at any moment the CEO of any one of those terrible corporations that produce the war industries that produce the instruments of war is necessarily out there lobbying for the U.S. to go to war. It's just they make clear that their continued production of these instruments of war depends on the Pentagon continuing to buy them. And how can the Pentagon continue justifying buying them? They have to be replaced. Why would they have to be replaced? They have to be used. So there is definitely an economic base here for the continuing wars.
The 2003 war against Iraq was the greatest strategic blunder in American history. Do you think the United States could slip into another great strategic blunder? And what would it be like to tackle a country like Iran, which is a huge country with a population of 80 million people?
Well, I think we've already carried out those blunders. Whether it leads us to the devastation of the Iraq war, we're still holding our breath to see. Hopefully it will not. But it's true, exactly what you say, Michael. Iran is 2.5 times the population of Iraq. It's a far bigger country. And while the sanctions against Iran in recent years have vitiated much of the middle-class life of ordinary Iranians and has brought some to real hunger and people have died for lack of access to medicines, that sort of thing, it has not been equivalent to the 12 years of absolute crippling sanctions that Iraq had gone through after the first Gulf War, right up until the moment of the second U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq that started in 2003, when the country was so weak, the military had been brought to its knees. That is absolutely not the case in Iran. Iran is a much stronger country. It's a regional leader. part of the tension between the U.S. and Iran for years has been the U.S. refusal to acknowledge that Iran is a leading economic, political, cultural influencer throughout the Middle East region, and to accept that and negotiate and use diplomacy on the basis of that. The U.S. has simply refused to acknowledge it. So if there were to be a full-scale war, it would be devastating. It would be devastating against U.S. troops that would be called in, U.S. pilots, U.S. bombers. It would also be devastating against the countries where U.S. troops, and remember, Michael, even right now when the numbers are very small of U.S. troops that are in Iraq, that are in Syria, we're talking a few thousand in these places, but there are overall 60,000 U.S. troops throughout the Middle East. There are huge bases in Qatar, in Bahrain, the home of the 6th Fleet of the U.S., in the whole region is filled with U.S. bases, some giant and some quite small, but all of them would be incredibly accessible targets militarily for Iran. It would also be very dangerous for the countries where those bases are located. And Iranian officials have made clear that if the U.S. retaliates and a full-scale war erupts, that they will target U.S. forces in these countries, and they've warned these countries, you better get the U.S. troops out, because otherwise your country is going to be at risk when we go after those troops. So they're making very clear what the consequences would be if the U.S. pushes this further. It would be a long-standing war. It would be a devastating war that would probably have some direct impact here at home by forces supportive of Iran, whether orchestrated by them or not. You know, we do hear a lot about the proxy militias and proxy forces of Iran around the region, and they do exist in a number of countries. It's also true that while Iran has provided training and arms and money to some of these militias, they don't completely control them. So it's not a situation where Iran would be able to turn them on and off like a faucet, and you know, they're not simply agents of the Iranian state. They are independent actors with a lot of Iranian influence, but it's not at all clear how much control Iran would have. So the notion that there would be wars popping up on a small scale throughout the region is a very real threat.
Let's talk about oil. We're coming to an end to our allotted time, Phyllis Menes, but I wanted to conclude with really what it's all been about, going all the way back to 1953 when the United States overthrew the government in Iran. It's all about oil. It was all about oil in Iraq. In fact, they called it Operation Iraqi Liberation, and when they realized that that stood for oil, they changed the term. This one, too, I think, because not only is it all about oil, but if the oil supply is disrupted, as it would be with an all-out war against Iran, that would really alter the world economy. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it certainly would. I think what's different now, I don't think the Iraq War was only about oil. It was certainly about oil. It was also about military bases. It was about the expansion of U.S. power. It was, if we look back at the first Gulf War in 1991, it was about showing the world that with the demise of the Soviet Union, the U.S. remained a superpower and was now showing the world that it was still a military superpower. So there's a host of reasons. Oil is certainly one of the central ones, and it still is, as you say. What's different now is the role of oil in the global economy has changed. It hasn't disappeared. It's still a major factor. The fossil fuel industry is still a huge player economically, and access to secure supplies of petroleum products is still crucial for world capitalism. That has not changed. But the levels have changed and are changing. The rise of non-fossil fuel renewable energy sources now exists throughout the world on a level that was simply unheard of back in 2003, when the last war started almost 20 years ago. It's a whole different understanding now. The use, for example, of the U.S., 10 years ago, the U.S. stopped relying on fossil fuels being imported and became a net exporter of fossil fuels. And at around the same time, the fuel that the U.S. was importing global from around the world shifted so that the Middle East has not been the main source for U.S. oil, for U.S. imported oil, for more than a decade and a half. it's far more is coming from Venezuela, still ironically, from Mexico and Canada, and from Africa, from Angola and elsewhere. So the role of oil production is still very important. It's actually probably more important for Russia and for countries in Europe than it is for the U.S. right now. But it is no longer the definitive shaper of world politics and the economy the way it has been, as you say, since even before 1953, but certainly since then, if we're looking at the question of Iran. So oil remains a major factor, but one of the things that we can, again, take a deep breath about is that it is no longer as definitive in shaping world affairs as it has been for far too long.
We've been speaking with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis, before I have to let you go, can you tell people how they can follow your work?
Sure. The website of IPS of the Institute for Policy Studies is ips-dc.org, and you can see my latest piece on this recent assassination and its aftermath from The Nation on that website or on The Nation's website.
Phyllis, thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder. I hope it doesn't come to this, but if it does, I'll see you in the streets.
Thank you, Michael. We'll be in the streets anyway to make sure it doesn't.
You take it easy, Phyllis.
You too.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The FBI is suffering a crisis of credibility, making news headlines not for solving crimes, but for agency shortfalls and blunders. From bureau officials lying to cover up leaks, to retaliation against internal whistleblowers, to agents facing criminal charges on obstruction, to leaking classified material, something is clearly amiss inside the nation's top law enforcement agency. There have also been several public failures, overlooked warnings in the Parkland, Florida school killings, delays in Olympic Dr. Larry Nassar's sexual misconduct probe, and misconduct by agents after armed militia standoffs in Nevada and Oregon. That is why Mike German's new book, Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy, is especially timely. German is a former FBI undercover special agent whose assignments included infiltrating white nationalist organizations. Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide focuses on how the Bureau transformed after the attacks of September 11, 2001. It went, German asserts, to being even more a covert domestic intelligence agency, unparalleled in U.S. history. He discusses how leaders took advantages of fears of terrorism to remove long-standing legal checks and balances on agents. By focusing on national security over law enforcement, the Bureau has in fact undermined public confidence in justice and the rule of law. Mike German is a fellow with the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's School of Law. He has worked at the ACLU and served 16 years as an FBI agent. He is also the author of Thinking Like a Terrorist.
Mike German, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much for having me.
Mike, congratulations on your new and very timely book. Let's start by learning, why did you write this book?
I wrote the book because the way the FBI has changed over the last two decades is seriously very significant. I don't think people really realize it. They hear a story here about a particularly abusive case or a intelligence failure there, and nobody put it together with an explanation of how and why it's happening. And so I thought it was important to get on the record, bringing all these stories together in a comprehensive narrative that showed what needed to be done to reform the system.
Now, you joined the FBI in 1988. You worked your first undercover case in 1992 during the Clinton administration. You talk about the church committee guidelines that curb or that were enacted to curb police overreaching. How did those guidelines inform your earlier work at the Bureau?
Anytime an agent gets a case, you basically read all the worst allegations that could be made against the person. You think this person is horrible, and I'm a good guy, and I'm being given this authority to go after the bad guys, and this person is clearly a bad guy, so all the stops should be out, and I should be given broad authority to go after them. But after you work for a little while, you realize that doesn't really make sense, because as you do the investigation, you find out maybe the allegation isn't quite as factually correct as you first thought, or that there's some other mitigating issues. And what I found, particularly doing undercover work, demanding the discipline of me objectively documenting the evidence that suggests the people I'm investigating are actually engaged in criminal activity, helped me focus those investigations properly on the most likely suspects, and that really helped quite a bit. I learned as I got experience that those standards weren't just there to protect people's civil liberties and privacy, but to actually make the agency more effective, because the resources are limited. You know, there are only 12,000 FBI agents across the entire country and around the world, so those resources aren't being used and targeted effectively. There's going to be a lot of waste and abuse. And one of the things I used to say, particularly when we saw the broadening of the FBI's authorities after 9/11, was that every time the FBI is investigating somebody who is innocent, is going after somebody because they're protesting rather than because they're breaking the law, those are resources that are wasted and not being used to target somebody who is actually doing harm.
And that's what we wanted to get into next. What happened in the FBI right after the events of 9/11? And tell us what the new FBI that you mention in your subtitle is.
So immediately after 9/11, there was an idea that was actually articulated. I mean, I heard agents say this, that the rules are off. You know, now there's this horrible attack, and because of that, we no longer have to comply with the Attorney General guidelines. The public and policymakers are happy with us stepping over the lines that used to regulate our work, and I found that quite troubling. Not just that as a law enforcement agency, scrupulously staying within the law is essential to the job, but also because that overreach would not only unnecessarily violate the civil liberties of many different groups and individuals, but would actually make us less effective. The way I articulated in the book is that it was both a change in attitude, that idea that we don't have to follow the law, and architecture, that they actually did start changing the rules as early as 2002. Obviously, the Patriot Act was passed within about a month, vastly expanded the FBI's surveillance authorities, mostly by taking away criminal predicates or reducing criminal predicates, and then changed to the Attorney General guidelines that we mentioned earlier, and many other changes to other intelligence collection laws like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that occurred originally illegally without any change to the law, just an ignoring of the law and a secret methodology, but eventually that was incorporated into basically legalized by Congress, these warrantless wiretapping programs. So it was this change in attitude and architecture. Part of the problem was there wasn't a very thorough review of what had actually gone wrong that led to the intelligence failure of 9/11 before all these changes were made, because what we ultimately found out was that intelligence failure of 9/11 was not an intelligence collection failure, but rather an intelligence management failure. In other words, we had plenty of information from which somebody could have made different decisions about how to act, but that information just didn't get from one hand to the other in a manner that helped the FBI FBI and the other intelligence agencies do their job more effectively to prevent the attacks. So if your problem is intelligence management, then opening the spigots to gather more wasn't going to help you. It was actually going to hurt you. And that's what I saw. That was going on at the same time that the FBI was actually changing what it said its primary mission was. You might remember back after 9/11, they were actually talking about taking terrorism away from the FBI, and the FBI thought the way to maintain their authorities was to say that they would change into a domestic intelligence agency. And I think that there wasn't really enough public debate about what that meant, what it meant to have a domestic intelligence agency in a democracy. And the way the FBI interpreted it was that their mission was no longer to enforce the law, to find people who were breaking or about to break the law, but rather to find people they believed were potential threats in the future. And that opened the door to bias influencing who was targeted by the powerful tools we give the FBI to go after criminals.
Mike German, you tell a really horrifying story about this fellow called Moshe Kwah and how the FBI had a chance to stop 9/11. Could you talk about that and talk about the role of Colleen Rowley, the FBI agent?
Sure. So, you know, again, 9/11 was not an intelligence collection failure. So there were a number of different threads that the FBI had gotten wind of that were tracking the different al-Qaeda operatives who became hijackers on 9/11. One of them was a French citizen named Zacharias Moussaoui, who had gone to flight schools first in Norman, Oklahoma, and then in Minneapolis, and attracted attention because he wasn't acting like a typical pilot trainer because of some strange behavior, including coming in with a lot of cash and not really having any aviation job and not really being as diligent as other pilots. The trainer got a little concerned and reported him to the FBI. The FBI did a little investigation in Minneapolis and found out that he had overstayed his visa, was out of status in his immigration, so there was a reason to go and arrest him. And they found a large amount of cash. They found a lot of strange things, knives. His roommate said that he had nefarious plans, so they wanted to do a broader investigation and sought a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act authorization, which is a secret court in D.C. that provides authorization to do national security searches. And through that process, there were a number of supervisors at headquarters who had previously had problems with that agent and were resisting his attempts to get this authorization to search Zacharias Moussaoui's computer and continued to say he didn't have enough evidence to seek a warrant. They never actually brought an affidavit to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and the agent, to his credit, would continue to go back and find more evidence. He obtained evidence from overseas that this Zacharias Moussaoui had connections to a Chechen group that was part of a terrorist organization. So the evidence was accumulating, but meanwhile, the headquarters supervisors continued to resist his request to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And ultimately, it was too late. And on 9/11, everybody realized that it was part of the plot. And ultimately, he was charged. But that was one of the threads that could have perhaps prevented that horrible attack from happening. And again, if we had diagnosed the problem correctly, and what I hoped at the time, because within the FBI, we knew all of these stories right away. The FBI has a lot of very curious people as investigators. It's quite a network, so you get information about what's happening elsewhere in the country very quickly. So right away, most FBI agents knew that there was this case in Minnesota, that there was an agent in Phoenix who had requested the FBI because his own al-Qaeda investigations were showing connections to aviation careers, that, you know, perhaps there was a national plan to attack aviation. There were cases in New York where two known al-Qaeda operatives had come to the United States, and investigators were prevented from investigating them. So we knew that the problem was intelligence management, but the FBI at the time was saying that there was no intelligence that could have prevented the attack. And so Colleen Lowry, who was the chief division counsel, the top lawyer providing advice in Minnesota, ultimately realized that, these statements that the FBI was making weren't true and would potentially impact the Massawi case when he was criminally prosecuted. So she went and wrote a letter to the director warning him that, his statements were not true, and telling the story of all the effort that the Minneapolis agents went to try to get this authorization to search his computer that ultimately did have evidence of the 9/11 plot. Unfortunately, her courageous effort to try to get attention and to turn the debate away from expanding intelligence collection authorities to instead focusing on managing information wasn't heard, and she had a difficult time. She was able to struggle to get to retirement so that she could retire with her pension, but part of the theme that runs through the book is showing how I interviewed a number of agents and talked about a number of agents that I wasn't able to personally interview, who saw problems within the FBI and tried to raise them to management attention, only to be retaliated against because of those efforts.
And Mike, we actually want to talk briefly about your own experience with that. But first, tell us about the radicalization theory of the FBI that you mentioned in the book. What is the theory and how is it used?
So I had been working domestic terrorism cases for about 10 years as an undercover agent and advising other cases. So I had really done a deep dive into the terrorism research. And at the time, there had been a debate in the 80s and 90s about what caused terrorism. And there was this school of mostly psychologists who believed there was some kind of mental defect that allowed somebody to engage in such horrible conduct against people who were not directly responsible for whatever this person was stealing. So they would do all kinds of psychological studies of captured terrorists, of terrorists in the wild who agreed to be part of a research project, to retired terrorists whose conflict had ended. And what they ultimately determined by about the mid-90s when I was doing that work was there was no mental defect, that this was unfortunately a rational act, and that the only way it could be understood is in the context of the conflict that's going on. There's all kinds of different political violence. There's state violence, military violence, police violence, and you couldn't look at why one person chose to engage in political violence without understanding the context around the violence that's going on in that situation. So right after 9/11, when I started hearing terms like radicalization being thrown around, and that's this idea that people are exposed to bad ideas, radical ideas, and that exposure pollutes their mind in a way that puts them down a path that makes them become a terrorist. It's an old theory. It goes back over 100 years. It was something that the FBI used in the early 1900s to go after anarchists. It was used during the 1950s and 60s to go after communists and socialists, and in the 60s and 70s to go after civil rights advocates. The theory was that if people are exposed to these bad ideas, they become dangerous, and it's only a matter of time before they engage in violence. So for an agency designed to prevent that violence, they should focus on the people with the bad ideas rather than trying to find the very few individuals who engage in violence. So after 9/11, when I heard this concept of radicalization being revived, I knew that that would be a problem. And unfortunately, that has become not just within law enforcement, foundational concept, but even in the media, as soon as you see some kind of violence taking place, the media will ask, how is this person radicalized? And it's this very unscholarly approach of looking at some website that they viewed and say, aha, that's the answer. They saw this website and they became radicalized, and therefore that's what caused it, rather than actually looking at each situation and analyzing all of the facts that are relevant.
And Mike, with that kind of, I won't call it investigation, but gathering of data related to profiling, you mentioned there's a huge influx of data. How is it managed in the Bureau, or rather, how is it mismanaged?
Two concepts come together. You have this broadening of collection, so there is so much more information and data coming into the FBI, and obviously it's impossible for this relatively small agency to be able to sift through this mass of data, mostly of innocent people, and determine who will be engaging in crime in the future. So they use this radicalization model to determine who they will target. And immediately after 9/11, the idea was that the problem wasn't one group called Al-Qaeda that had a particular ideology and political goals, but rather the problem was Muslim radicalization. And so that meant that every Muslim was suspect, because any Muslim could be vulnerable to these radical ideas or recruited by a radical group, and therefore mass surveillance programs targeting Muslim communities in the United States, programs limiting or putting security measures on people traveling to the United States from Muslim countries, these became de rigueur and part of the process for how the FBI did its what it called intelligence. But unfortunately, what that does is create a lot of bad information that's coming in that makes it much more difficult to identify who the people that are actually doing harm, number one, but also imposes abuses upon completely innocent communities.
And isn't there also a third point? What happens to other crimes that are being committed across the country that the FBI used to focus on? Who's handling those now?
That is a huge problem. And it's really interesting when you look at crime rates, because if you go back to the 80s and 90s, the violent crime rates were peaking, were very high, and they have come down significantly since then. But when you look at the most serious crime, violent crime, that clearance rate, the rate at which those cases are solved, has actually come down with them. So even though we have these broad surveillance programs and mass collection and video surveillance, electronic surveillance, we're actually solving fewer of the most serious crimes that affect most Americans. And of course, a lot of those crimes are crimes committed by the state, whether it's police violence, whether it's illegal surveillance, whether it's financial crimes. We just don't investigate and prosecute those cases very much. So, to the extent that we have this concept of national security, it only makes sense if it's actually protecting the people within our nation. But the concept, as it's understood within the Beltway, within the national security establishment, is that there are certain people that deserve protection, even protection from having the laws imposed upon them, and then there's the rest of us who are the suspects. Seen this time and time again, wherever a conflict erupts somewhere around the world, people in the United States, whether they're green card holders or citizens who have some attachment to that country, are all of a sudden under the FBI's gaze and are often questioned in what are called voluntary interviews, where an agent shows up at their door or at their workplace, or other kind of suppressive activities that aren't really helping anybody's security, and in fact are undermining the security of the communities that they target.
Mike, we just have a few minutes remaining. Briefly, can you talk about your own experience at the FBI when you brought forth information you thought your superiors would want to know about? What happened?
Sure. So I was an FBI special agent, and you know, while I had concerns about the approach the FBI was taking, my job was to just do the investigations that I was assigned to the most professional extent possible. And I was assigned to a case that involved supporters of international terrorist groups reaching out to domestic terrorist groups asking for assistance. This was in 2002. It seemed like a perfect opportunity for the FBI to show that it could work a sophisticated case, and I was assigned to work at the undercover role with both of these groups, but the case was seriously mismanaged. There was an informant who wasn't properly instructed, who engaged in some illegal monitoring, and when I discovered that, that was something that was going to imperil a prosecution. So I knew I couldn't go forward with it. What didn't make sense to go forward with the case if the prosecution would fall apart because of the illegal recording. So I reported it at the chain of command, only to find resistance at every stage, and ultimately made a whistleblower complaint. But instead of correcting the problems with the case, they altered the FBI documents to make it appear as if they had not made those errors and came after me as the source of the problems. And I tried for 2 years to bring that around, but ultimately realized that my time at the FBI was up. And so I resigned 2 years later and reported it all to Congress, hoping again to influence the way the changes were being made. But because I couldn't talk about the details of the case, it's hard to get the public's attention. I don't think ultimately that was effective at all in changing the FBI's attitude or its interest in changing the architecture.
Well, one wonderful byproduct of all of that is that you are now really serving the public interest, most recently with your new book, Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide. It's been receiving wonderful reviews. Michael and I loved it, and we are so honored that you could join us to discuss your book. We will look forward to hearing how it does and hoping to stay in touch with you, Mike German, in the future.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And your work has been an inspiration to me and an educating tool to help me put it in a form that makes sense. So thanks very much for all you do as well.
Thanks for the compliment, Mike. You take it easy.
Yeah. Take care.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.